Hello, this time on SITREP, Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer vows to make Britain one of the great AI superpowers.
It's the present, in Britain, changing lives, a chance to turbocharge growth, create the companies of the future, and radically improve our public services.
But the Ministry of Defence has given a stark warning that it needs to play catch-up and should learn from Ukraine's use of AI on the battlefield. In Cyprus, riflemen have spent 7 weeks undergoing one of the most testing selection courses in the British Army, and all to gain their first stripe. And what makes a good spy? We delve into the latest declassified documents with instructions on appearance, disguise, and how to follow targets.
SITREP
with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Mike, when we last talked about AI, in spite of your self-declared analogue lifestyle, you conceded we're all going to have to embrace it, and the MOD has been told to do so, and in no uncertain terms, and to get on with it or risk falling behind its adversaries.
Yeah, I mean, the MOD had an AI strategy which came out in, 3 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, 2022, in the summer of that year. And it was fine as far as it went. There were three pillars to it. But it was really looking at the way in which AI can aid procurement. It certainly can help industry, no question about that. And the use of synthetic environments, which again is very useful and has been on the stocks for a little while. But actually, I mean, AI is much more fundamental than that. And there are bigger ways in which it changes conceptually the way we might think about the future battle space. And the point is, our adversaries are certainly thinking about these things. So we shouldn't just regard AI, I think this is a challenge to the MOD. It's not just another clever piece of computing that those who don't really understand supercomputing don't need to worry about. You can't leave this to the IT department. This is something that will go right through the defence establishment, right down to tactical battlefield issues. And that's a big challenge.
And this all comes in a report by the Defence Committee. It points to Ukraine and the advances it's made using artificial intelligence in its near 3 years of war. The MOD, the report says, must learn those lessons too. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from someone who gave evidence to the report. But first, let's go to our Ukraine reporter, Simon Newton. Simon, hello there. Before we get into this, some new developments and announcements on Britain's and Ukraine's long-term relationship.
Yes, so Keir Starmer has made a surprise visit to Kyiv to sign a 100-year agreement with President Zelensky today. And it covers a whole kind of spectrum of things, some cultural, some military, some economic. There's an element there about maritime security, about Britain helping Ukraine in the future to secure the Black Sea, the Baltic, etc. Some talk about energy, critical minerals, and a £40 million lump sum effectively that we're going to give to the Ukrainians to help them with this post-war recovery as and when it comes. So it covers a whole spectrum of things. In terms of the military side of things, there is a talk, it's not actually in the agreement, but one of the things they're going to talk about clearly is this idea that President Macron put forward actually about British troops being involved in patrolling some areas of Ukraine in the future, you know, as peacekeepers, post any sort of ceasefire that might take place. And I think it's the key thing here, of course, is the timing of all of this. We've got President Trump's inauguration next week, so I think it's no accident that, you know, Keir Starmer has turned up in Kyiv at the moment to try and get in there first, if you like, before the mystery of what Donald Trump's going to do next kind of emerges.
And Simon, on the report by the Defence Committee that Britain should learn from Ukraine on artificial intelligence, what is Ukraine actually using on the battlefield and more widely in this war?
Well, I think the first thing to stress is that this technology is widespread, but it's kind of in its infancy, essentially tactically on the battlefield. They are using it for some of their attacks on Russian troops within drones, usually. The key things here is you need a lot of data to make these AI drones work. You need upgraded cameras on them to make them have target recognition. So that this is a kind of a moving sense of technology that we're going through. And they're burning through about 1,000 drones a month. So there's obviously a cost implication. But, you know, drones and Ukraine itself has been a massive accelerator for this sort of technology, for drone technology per se. I spent time with a drone developer in Kyiv. He was telling me that they're developing a drone there that will be able to go out to a specific part of the battlefield, recognize a T-80 or T-90 Russian tank, and effectively know that it's not a Challenger tank, for instance, and it will be able to go and attack that particular Russian vehicles. They are using some basic AI, we understand, on some of these longer range drones that they're using to attack deep inside Russia. You know, we've seen that attack in Saratov this week around Engels as well. They're using them there, with some AI drones apparently being used to go and effectively jam the Russian air defences and also attack those air defences while the other ones go and hit the target themselves. In Chasiv Yar, I was reading that they are, some of the drone operators are actually sort of bolting on effectively AI tech, very cheap AI tech, to their drones so that they can use terrain mapping for that last critical mile before they hit the target to avoid this very effective jamming that the Russians are using. So it is being used, and it's all being used. It's kind of a little bit piecemeal, I would say, at the moment, but there is clearly a real move, as I'm sure James will explain shortly, to make this tech, so useful, and it is so useful to the Ukrainians, given they don't have the mass the Russians have.
And Mike, to what extent are Ukraine's advances in AI born of necessity? What they lack in mass, they might make up for by maximising the efficiency or capability of what they do have.
Yes, because originally it's a problem of artillery. They never had enough artillery tubes or artillery shells to match the Russians. I mean, they were using at their peak, really, sort of about 8,000 shells a day. The Russians have used up to 15 or even 20,000 shells a day, and they outmatched them at local points on the battlefield. And the Ukrainians found quite quickly that if they could use drones, and if they could use counter battery artillery technologies and then upgrade them themselves with their own software, they were able to be much more efficient in counter battery fire. So they were able to operate a kind of taxi rank system, whereby they not only located where the artillery shelling was coming from, but could allocate the right sort of weapon, whether it was an aircraft with a missile or a drone or an artillery battery of their own. They could locate it literally within a few seconds and fire back very, very quickly. And that was very useful to them in the early stages of the war. The Russians have caught up with that now. But increasingly, drone technology is their substitute for having enough artillery shells. And they're just on the verge, I think, as Simon said, they haven't quite, nobody's quite got the hang yet of applying AI to a whole swarm of drones, which in a sense would be given their own area of responsibility, and they'll make their own command decisions within that designated area for a designated time. But we're just on the verge of that now. This is almost, swarming drones are an autonomous weapon system about to arrive. And if it's going to arrive anywhere in the world at an operational level, I'll guess it will arrive in Ukraine.
Let's bring in James Black now, Assistant Director of the Defence Team at RAND Europe, the world's largest policy research organisation, and he gave evidence to the report. James, good to have you on SITREP. Nice to see you. When this report was presented to the House of Commons, the question was raised by the Chair of the Defence Committee whether the MOD, in reality, still treats AI as a novelty. Does it?
So I think, as Mike's already alluded to, there has been a defence AI strategy in the last few years, and there's been a whole raft of different initiatives to try and unlock the kind of raw potential around military AI. And I think, as has been discussed, that covers not just the warfighting end of things, but also some of the kind of less sexy back office functions that AI can also be applied to enhance productivity, reduce admin, faff for staff officers, all these sorts of things that we'd all appreciate. I think it's worth stressing it's not all doom and gloom. The UK definitely has huge potential in AI, and I think that's what the Prime Minister has been trying to obviously unlock with some of the announcements this week. We are home to a lot of big tech companies in that space. We do have a lot of good human capital and expertise, and within the MOD there's been the Defence AI Unit and the Defence AI Centre really trying to push things. At the same time, I think, as the committee inquiry kind of makes clear, there is a kind of say-do gap potentially at here, and so there, we need to close the gap between some of the rhetoric and the resource and really kind of mainstream AI rather than, yes, as you've said, it being a novelty. And I think why that is so urgent is we have to stress the pace of technological change here. you know, this is not something that's moving at a linear pace, it's moving exponentially. So if you look at the, you know, latest iterations of things like ChatGPT and other large language models, they are getting better much, much, much more quickly than anyone can really keep up with. And so organizations like the MOD aren't necessarily the most agile, as we all know. And there's a real risk that, you know, some of our competitors get ahead of us. So I think it's not just about, you know, we need to do more in order to get a new advantage. It's we need to do more just to kind of keep up with parity with some of our key competitors and allies.
And on that point, then, if we don't keep up, what could that mean to our troops on the battlefield, James?
So, I mean, if you know, we take the UK and the US and China and all these other countries' Departments of Defense's assessments at kind of face value, AI is going to be one of the big disruptive kind of dominant features of the future battle space. It enables you to make decisions faster, better, at various stages of the kind of kill chain, enables you to optimize things like logistics, enables you to, you know, automate things like electronic warfare and jamming, cyber attacks, those sorts of things. So it has a profound impact across kind of all domains and all aspects of how we fight and how we then organize ourselves behind the front lines. And so if we surrender, you know, a lead in that space, that obviously opens us up to all sorts of threats, both from state actors, but also non-state actors. And we have to remember with things like, say, drones, which are obviously a hardware technology, but they can have AI software associated with them. Those are things that are now widely available. You know, we've seen that, say, the Houthis in the Red Sea. You know, the UK MOD has been very clear it wants responsible military AI. And part of that is about us applying it in an ethical way. But part of it is also being responsible in the sense that we keep up and we make sure we have a strong defense through incorporating these sorts of technologies quicker than the other guy.
And Mike, on that point about keeping up, you mentioned the AI strategy. The Defence Committee heard that whole paragraphs of that AI strategy, which was written 6 years ago, had simply been copied and pasted into the latest edition. How does the MOD have to change to actually become more agile on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the sort of erstwhile dynamics of defence decision-making, because in the MOD, you've got a group of civil servants who are reasonably permanent, and then a group of military officers who come in to do an appointment for two and a half, 3 years and rotate. And that's important, that the military is there alongside the civil service, but neither the civil service nor the military can compete with industry in the sheer expertise of whatever it is you're interested in, whether it's maritime technologies or torpedo advances or aerospace stuff. Industry knows more about the technical side of that than the MOD ever will. So you've got these three separate groups, you know, the military, whose view is very important, the civil servants who have to live with the longer term procurement challenges, and then industry itself. And that's inherent in the way the defence has to work. But AI really challenges, as James is saying, the pace at which anybody in the MOD can learn. It really challenges the difference or the gap in the physical or rather intellectual expertise between those who are at the sharp end of these technologies and those in the MOD who have to take, as it were, big strategic decisions as to what to invest in and what not to invest in, more importantly or as importantly. And so that's a sort of an old-fashioned dynamic in the MOD, which is now even more important to address.
Let's just bring it back to the battlefield and to Ukraine itself. Simon, we talked about what Ukraine has in terms of AI. What about their adversary? What does Russia have, and how good is it at AI in Ukraine?
They reportedly have two detachments of AI drones operating in eastern Ukraine around Belgorod and in Kursk, obviously that region of Russia that the Ukrainians are trying to hold on to, well, this foothold at least. And they plan to equip five more units with these robot UAVs in the near future. So they're just as focused on it as the Ukrainians are. And it's actually, from what I can read, a bit of a pet subject for Vladimir Putin. He's talked about it and talked about it long before the Ukrainian war began. And the Russian MOD actually has a specialized department for the development of AI. The best example, or one of the good examples, would be the Lancet 3, the loitering munition, a bit like the American Switchblade that the Russians use, which has been very successful for them. And that has a sort of a terrain mapping AI function. It can locate and destroy a target without human guidance. So they are also putting it onto things like their S-500 air defence systems, apparently, into artillery, into aviation. So they tend to incorporate it into their existing systems. But I guess the irony here is that the Russian military has been decimated during this war, but the byproduct of that has been the data that they've got on the battlefield. And that is one of the key things that you need to build a robust and effective AI system. So in that sense, they've gained, you know, where they've lost as well.
And James, in terms of being good at AI, is there an underlying truth here that under other countries, apart from Ukraine, that feel an existential threat are bound to lead the field in AI because they feel the urgency?
Yeah, I think that's one of the key challenges. And I mean, both Mike and Simon have alluded to that, is that if you are going to adopt AI at pace, you need to adopt a kind of fundamentally different approach to both procurement, but also your relationship with industry. Because, you know, AI, like any software, is something that is built iteratively. It's not a, you know, a shiny box that turns up and you plug it in and it's good to go. It's about having a long-term kind of iterative relationship, feedback between the military end users and then the you know, data scientists and the technical people who are updating the AI models, changing the weights in those models, improving and optimizing. That's a very different model, and it involves inherently a bunch of risk. You know, it involves policy risk, it involves financial risk, reputational risk, what if things go wrong, and of course, therefore, operational risk. Now, you can push through some of those bureaucratic and cultural barriers if you're someone like Ukraine facing an existential threat, because you recognize that the risk of inaction is greater than the risk of action. It's harder if you're still in a sort of peacetime mindset. And so that's why things like the Defense AI Center, Commercial X, which is its kind of experimental commercial function, and other efforts within the UK have tried to push aside some of that mentality. But obviously, it's still something that's quite entrenched. And it's going to take time to fully resolve.
Really good to hear your thoughts. James Black, Simon Newton, thanks very much. Now, it's the biggest step up a soldier will make in their army career, getting their first stripe and promotion to Lance Corporal. So when SITREP Sophie Kakayanis was granted exclusive access to the selection course in Cyprus, it was a unique opportunity to record the highs and the lows of the entire seven-week experience.
Morning, troops.
Morning, sir.
Welcome to the sword lane.
Noah!
Noah!
Bring!
Noah!
Bring!
Bring!
High ball!
Well, that was soldiers on the latest One Rifles Junior Non-Commissioned Officer Cadre on the Sword Lane part of the course. More of that in a moment, but Sophie joins us now. Sophie, tell us a bit more about the course. How is it put together? Who goes on it and how are they put to the test? I mean, they're selected, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. So One Rifles are currently based in British Forces Cyprus. So that's why theirs took place there. The chain of command decide whether their riflemen or private soldiers, if it's another regiment, are ready to take that next step up in the army to become a Lance Corporal. It's split across 7 weeks into about three phases. So you've got that first phase, which is honing in those soldiering skills. So navigation theory, being battle fit, can you work well in a team? The second phase then being in the field, so acting in the role of a Lance Corporal out in the field, delivering orders for the first time, showing leadership skills out in the field when you're really sleep deprived and the weather is really intense. And then the culmination of that was Sword Lane, which you heard earlier. And then the third and final phase of the course, which is about bringing that mindset back to camp as well. So you're responsible for how junior soldiers fire their weapons on the ranges, making sure your drill is up to scratch, which wasn't a favourite of a lot of the soldiers. And they even got a sneak peek into the sergeant's mess to see what life could be like if they carried on climbing up the ranks.
Indeed. You mentioned Sword Lane. We heard a bit of it. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, so it's a rite of passage on a junior NCO cadre to have a Sword Lane. It's not new to the soldiers. They do a Sword Lane or Bayonet Lane at Catterick. However, this one was after a grueling 3 weeks out in the field, many of them not having slept for the 36 hours before it. And on top of that, they then had a military knowledge test that was thrown on them immediately after that they definitely weren't expecting. So really grueling. it's to recreate the scenario that on the brink of exhaustion, these soldiers are put into a scenario where they're isolated from their comrades and they must use their bayonets, or in this case, as the rifles refer to them, as swords, to defeat the enemy to survive. The whole Sword Lane focuses on controlled aggression. Warrant Officer Class 2 Lee Fraser explains more. He's the company Sergeant Major of B Company in One Rifles.
That's what we expect from our junior NCOs. We expect them to go that extra mile, to find that last 10% inside them and push themselves all the way through to the end without quitting. And every single one of them this morning proved that they've got that fighting spirit, the aggression, to get through to the end. And every single one of them performed phenomenally.
Yeah, and Sophie, WO2 Fraser, he'd know exactly what it's all about, isn't it? Because it's not just the soldiers taking part that are put through the ringer. Many of the battalion soldiers, other soldiers, prepare and run the course. And so it's a big undertaking for the unit, for everybody involved.
Definitely. So although this junior NCO cadre was run by One Rifles, there were soldiers from Three Rifles, Four Ranger and the 1st Battalion, the Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment, who were also based in Cyprus. And the directing staff were a reflection of that. But this has months and months of planning that goes into it. And the directing staff are away from their family and friends. Those from like Three Rifles had come over from Scotland, so needed to acclimatise as well. There's a lot of moving parts, as well as the battalions also losing those soldiers for a few months, so them having to make mitigations as well back at the barracks.
And the chance to get your first stripe does mean more than just money, but it's the, because they get a promotion, they get more money, but it's about respect, isn't it? And responsibility. What they want to achieve is much more than just money.
Yeah, let's face it. I mean, pay is a massive deal. It's why a lot of us will go for promotion, whether we're civvies or in the military, and that is a big part of it. But you're right, it's also about career progression. People don't join the army necessarily to stay as riflemen or private soldiers. They want to climb that ladder. They want the career progression, and they want the responsibility of making those decisions out in the field and start climbing that leadership ladder, as well as wanting to move up the ranks with their mates as well. Nobody wants to get left behind. I got a real sense of how much it means to them and the relief of it being over when I caught up with a few of the soldiers after the final parade.
Yeah, proud. It's, you know, that's job done now. So time to go home.
I've been able to rank up today, so I'm really, really happy. As a human being, always expect to progress in life because that's what we are all living for.
Yeah, I do feel proud. Yeah, done the course, passed the course. Just want to go out and go see my family now, so yeah.
What's been the best? Probably this moment right now. It's finally finished it all. You know, being able to go back and relax. And then the hardest would probably be sword. Sword was pretty tasty.
And Sophie, I mean, they all sound delighted there. But passing the cadre, it doesn't mean necessarily mean immediate promotion, does it? Can you just explain that?
Yeah, so all of these soldiers that have passed are now eligible for promotion. So they will go for Lance Corporal jobs. And it's when they get that Lance Corporal job and they pass the board, they then get their new rank slide. And that is when they can then be called a Lance Corporal. But just like the civilian equivalent of, you think of university graduates, when you then graduate, you're competing against other graduates for jobs as well. So these people that have promoted to Lance Corporal, they'll also be competing for other people that have promoted and maybe on the last cadre that then got injured and are now going for a Lance Corporal job. So we think those that came in the top part of the course are likely, hopefully, a few months after the course to get promoted. But it is thought that within 1 year of this course finishing, all of them who passed out on the parade should be in Lance Corporal jobs.
You know, Sophie, I was watching your report earlier. It's a really interesting special report. And the thing that really struck me was like how it was for you, like running alongside them, because it was look grueling enough for those taking part. But I was wondering how you got on. But also, you know, there you were asking these soldiers questions and they're like virtually panting through their answers. And I thought, I hope they don't fail because they're being interviewed by a journalist. Can you tell me what sticks in your mind from spending a bit of time with these soldiers?
Yeah, definitely. You're very mindful of... If I was you, I couldn't think of anything less I'd want to do right now than do an interview to camera. And I think it's just knowing when to ask those questions and maybe when not to, but also talking to them just on a human level, you know, when the camera isn't rolling, about what is it that you really miss at home. Some of the soldiers, one of them, he was missing football because he didn't know how his team were getting on and he missed having a kickabout. One of them was really wanting a steak, you know, and some red wine and was really missing that. I thought a lot of them would actually say they were missing their beds, but no, it seems they're more than happy to be camping out in the field. So I suppose they're in the right job. But yeah, it was really grueling. And there was a lot more involved than I think I initially thought. There's a lot of responsibility on young shoulders. And it really is a really big step up for them, because it is the first time they will ever be leading soldiers. It's the first time as well that anyone's going to be looking up to them as well. Now they've passed, they're going to be responsible for inspiring and leading a new group of soldiers, getting them to places on time, being in charge of their welfare. And I think that really set in by the end of the course. I mean, they say that Lance Corporal is the hardest rank to get and the easiest one to lose.
Sophie, really good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can watch Sophie's special report on the Forces News YouTube channel now. Micah, we know who commands the army. We know that becoming an officer is no mean feat. But given that the army cannot function without the NCOs and relies on them for so many things, this course is one of the most demanding, because it has to be.
Yes. I mean, Alexander the Great famously is said to have said that I'm not frightened of an army of lions led by sheep, but I am very frightened of an army of sheep led by lions. And the point is that leadership is absolutely fundamental, and it goes all the way down through an army from the very top to the very base. And the NCOs of any army are the backbone, the absolute backbone of a good army. And as you said at the beginning of that report, the biggest step up for a private soldier is the first step up to Lance Corporal, Lance Jack, as my dad used to refer to them, the Lance Jacks. And because when you become an NCO, a junior NCO, you are fundamentally stepping away from just being a private soldier. And as with all officers, whether from, you know, captain, major, right down to the sergeant's very, very important, the corporal, the lance corporal, the issue there is that you've got to be at least as good as all your private soldiers at the basic drills and skills. And then you've got the extra. Because in operations, in whether it's exercises or real operations and real battle, there is always chaos. And the group of men that you're, and some women that you will be responsible for, when things are chaotic, they'll look to you. They'll wonder what you are thinking. What are you going to do? And so it comes down, you know, a lieutenant might be in charge of a platoon of 20 odd people. But then the corporal and the lance corporal have got to look after, say, six people. In particular, as well as being mindful of all of the others. And they look to you. And so when you're tired and fed up and confused, you've still got to exercise leadership. So you still have to be, if they are behaving like sheep, you have to be a lion. And as long as it's lions leading sheep, then Alexander the Great will be frightened of your army.
Well, let's continue the idea of selection now, not to the rank of Lance Corporal, but something entirely different. Don't worry, it will become clear. But Mike, if I may, just a couple of personal questions, if that's okay with you.
Of course, yeah, go on.
Yes. How tall are you, Mike?
Oh, I think I know where this is going. Right, I'm 6'1". Right.
Okay, how's your eyesight and your hearing?
Well, I'm just in the middle of a cataract procedure for my eyes, so that's
okay.
Send it
all right.
And my hearing, I've taken to wearing hearing aids. So there you are.
Okay, and are you a patient man? Actually, I know the answer to that question because you work with me every week.
I'm only patient sometimes. I would have to say. Okay. No, I'm tall. I've got poor eyesight, poor hearing, and relatively limited patience. There you are.
Oh dear. Well, I'm afraid based on those responses, Mike, you would actually fail as a spy, according to a recently declassified guide on espionage, observation, as it were. You have to be 5'7", according to this guide, or ideally 5'8". You have to have excellent hearing, sight, and be very patient. Well, you scored on that, that's for sure, I think, anyway. This is according to a 17-page guide by MI5, dating back to the Second World War. It's just been released by the National Archives. What do you make of it, Mike? You had a look, didn't you?
Yes, I was having a look at it yesterday. It's very interesting because in some respects it is absolutely up to date in the fundamentals of particularly surveillance that I was looking at. But of course it was quaint in the sense that the way it was expressed, it was assuming that everyone you deal with is a he, not only a he,
that's
only
true,
for
yeah.
men. And it was accompanied by some illustrations, which looked like something out of a Punch cartoon. It was hard to take them seriously. But the fundamentals of surveillance, to be somebody who can absolutely and completely blend in with their background, somebody who is completely unremarkable, that's fundamental to all active agents in the field. That's why, as we always say many times, James Bond is a lousy agent, absolutely lousy, because he draws attention to himself all the time. He's far too handsome. He's far too tall. He's far too active. He's got the police on his tail all the time. And, I mean, not least, he goes around telling people his name. I mean, that's not a great recommendation, is it?
Yeah, and Mike, I mean, we talked about height, but this book, I mean, talk about quaint, it also goes into look, and it says that no moustache, okay, but you've got to adapt to your locality. So if you're in the slum quarters, it says, he must wear old clothes, a cap, muffler, etc., and be better dressed for the West End.
Yeah. Do you know, when I read that, I was thinking of a book by Tom Marcus called Soldier Spy, which came out only about six or eight years ago now. And Tom Marcus was a special forces man who worked with the Special Reconnaissance Regiment between 2005, the London bombings, and 2010. And the book's about lots of different things that he did. But one of the things that was so interesting to me is that he spent some time, quite a lot of time, becoming basically a down and out homeless person, lying in a doorway so that he could observe the comings and goings in particular streets. And in order to do this, he would grow his hair, he would grow a beard, he wouldn't wash for a week or so before he went on to the operation. He had a special set of clothes which were filthy, which were covered in alcohol and urine, and he would just lie there and occupy this doorway for days and nights on end to observe the street. And, you know, I mean, people would come along. I mean, say that, you know, yobs would come along during the night and abuse him and spit at him and urinate on him and kick him. And, you know, he was, a young, fit, kill-you-with-his-bare-hands special forces soldier who had to lie there and pretend to be a middle-aged man who couldn't look after himself. And there's almost something, I wouldn't say romantic, but poignant in that, because it reminded me an awful lot of the, you know, things, the old Edwardian novels like The Four Feathers or The 39 Steps.
And Mike, this comes ahead of a collaboration between the National Archives and MI5 for an exhibition in the spring. It's fascinating. And by the way, if it's any consolation, the author of this booklet, Observations, concludes that after many years of experience, the ideal watcher is born and not made. And unless he has a natural flair for the work, he will never rise above the mediocre standard. That says off the hook, Mike.
Yes, exactly. I feel better about that.
Thank you so much, Mike, and thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. Bye for now.